Today on Against the Grain, we spend much of our lives at work, and, especially in this country, our identities are often closely tied to our jobs. And yet work, along with being exploitative and demeaning, is often meaningless as well. Journalist and playwright Barbara Garson set out 50 years ago to understand how Americans viewed and tried to shape their work, and the result was a classic book, subsequently revised, called All the Livelong Day. She discusses work then and now, during the so-called Great Resignation. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. When we go to work, we often give up most of our rights and find ourselves at the mercy of our employers. But that doesn't mean that we don't find ways to exert our own power and autonomy over the work process. As Barbara Garson argues, workers are remarkably creative in the ways they subvert the boredom of their jobs, generate meaning for themselves, and otherwise exercise some control over their work. Garson explored that creativity in her classic book, All the Livelong Day, The Meaning and Demeaning of Routine Work, which was published by Penguin and which we're revisiting today. In it, she spoke to workers around the country about how they saw their work and work process, sometimes working side by side with them. Garson is also the author of Down the Up Elevator, The Electronic Sweatshop, and the play McBird. Barbara, when you wrote the first edition of All the Livelong Day, it was in a moment coming out of the 1960s and 70s when there was a great deal of dissatisfaction with work and a focus on the alienating nature of it. And then in the 1990s, when you revised the book, much of the industry that people worked in the U.S. that had been so strikingly alienating was actually in the process of leaving the country. And now, we're at a time again when the alienation of work, following the many dislocations of COVID, is now back in the news. How do you understand the waxing and waning of at least the explicit public revulsion to the meaninglessness of work under capitalism?
It's just class war continuous. The availability of jobs, the ability to make you be able to move from one to another is what makes you start thinking, oh, I can't take this anymore. Listen, when I wrote All the Livelong Day, the first thing that happened was there was a strike, an unofficial strike in an auto plant in Lordstown, Ohio. And suddenly there were headlines, young workers want to change the speed of the line, young workers talk about humanizing the job. And so with an interest that I didn't quite share, a notion that it was generational, how will American industry continue if everyone is a hippie? I was sent down to Lordstown, or rather, it was easy for me to get a commission to go to Lordstown and interview these so-called hippie workers. Because after all, I was a young hippie then too. Sort of. I was never that hip. And I got to this place where this particular plant was the model. It was going to be the fastest. It was, for a while, the fastest automobile assembly line in the world. Cars were coming past at 101 an hour, which meant that people had 36 seconds along the line to do whatever snap or twist or spray you had to do on your part. And the company had started a brand new plant. This is General Motors. And they hired all young workers because they didn't have all the solidarity, they supposed, of the people in the UAW, and because they had to work fast, and they would be younger, and they would be healthier. And they opened the plant, and they're going at 101 cars an hour, and then suddenly they speeded it up because they saw ways to make it even faster, and you had these strikes, supposedly, and by the way, it was an unofficial strike to begin with. Workers were suddenly talking about humanizing the line. And people said, oh, we'll never be able to have industry again if this is what it's about. And in fact, they were even talking about sabotage. The management of the plant said the place was being sabotaged. They stopped saying that very soon because they realized you don't sell cars very well if people think the cars have been sabotaged, even if the people sympathize with you against these young workers. So I went down there. And yes, they were all young, and yes, they had some tendency to be hippie-ish, but they did have this good union job. And they were, in fact, talking about how they would like to do more different parts of the job, or what was wrong with the car. And I didn't find the sabotage people talked about, but what they said they did, I don't know if they did it this accurately, was when they suddenly speeded up the line by 10%, 1 out of 10 cars would be damaged in some way, or people would not do their particular item on 1/10. Whether they could be that accurate, I don't know. But that and that only was the sabotage they were talking about, not people just randomly smashing up cars. And everybody was saying, it's not the money, it's the job, and telling me about their work. And they were really very funny, and they knew a lot about cars, and they cared about cars. And I learned about cars. Now, remember, this is a time, we're talking 1975, it's easy to get a job. Not always a union job with this pay, but if you were a young person and you liked a band in Cincinnati, and you just wanted to go hear them a lot, you could go to Cincinnati and be sure that in a couple of days you could get some kind of job in some kind of little manufacturing place where you could rent an apartment or share an apartment and, you know, eat and not worry about any of these things. That was the era. Now we're told we're in that era again. We hear a lot about how people are quitting jobs and people are looking for jobs and looking for workers. Well, no, not quite. When you lose a really good job, it's not so hard to get it again. But the jobs that are most common in the country now, the jobs that we call low-wage, miserable jobs, formerly people known as essential workers, now just minimum wage workers, those jobs are easy to get. In fact, they're almost the only ones left. And so the people holding their jobs suddenly have options, have choices, and we begin to hear about something that I haven't heard about in 5 decades, the actual conditions of the work, both in terms of health and satisfaction and production and so on. And suddenly we're hearing them again. Now, when I first heard them, the idea was, the idea of the people who sent me the magazines to record it was, well, this is all hippies. This is a big change. And I did go to Lordstown, and they were young. But then I started going all over the country looking at people on their, what I thought was standard American jobs. Like, I went to this tuna fish plant, a bumblebee plant in Astoria, Oregon. And again, you know, I sort of gravitated to people that I'm young too, that would talk to me. For instance, waiting outside the tuna plant, kind of smelly out there, a young lady came out and her boyfriend had been waiting for her. And so I started to interview her about the job. I said, well, because her job was taking the skinned loins of tuna, which are quarters of tuna, really, and separating the dark meat from the light meat. And I said, well, what do you do all day? And she said, I daydream. And I said, about what? And she said, sex. And her boyfriend behind her, who was just hanging off her, said, that's my fault. He sort of proudly apologized. And she says, no, it's the fish. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, you know, the fish out here smells bad, but in there it's soft, it's fresh, it's sweet, it's very sensual. And she explained to me that her job was pulling out the dark meat, which went on one belt, that would go into the cat food, and boning the rest and putting it on another belt. And then she had to keep out the bones. That was so the inspectors could come around and see how well she cleaned and how many she did, because the tuna had the same number of these big central bones down its back, like we do. So they could check her, very primitive, much different than the Lordstown plant. They could check her by counting her bones. And she said that the dark meat was very sensual to her. Well, I thought, well, yeah, right, that's a young person. And I was perhaps a little intimidated to talk to what I thought was the stodgy, old, conservative workers. This was a Finnish town, and other people that came out of the place were wearing scarves covering their heads completely, and they didn't just take them off, and they had big rosy cheeks. But when I started talking to them, and at first I said, well, do you prefer the dog meat or the light meat? People thought I was crazy. And then they all had some story to tell about what they really preferred, some veins, some things. And I found that they were much more sophisticated. For instance, the bones, as I said, was to check how many you did so that the supervisors could come behind and see what you were up to. Well, in this particular place, when someone was new or fumbling, or particularly being harassed by one of the men's supervisors. And it's in 1972, and people knew what they were talking about then, too. They used slightly different words. And they wanted that person not to get in trouble. They would pass the bones over to somebody else, so that apparently that person was keeping up, even if she wasn't, or even going ahead. People were in competition. And they did all have preferences about the tuna. And I stayed in that town for about 2 weeks, and I went back and I saw that woman, Starlene, again. And she said, well, the dark meat wasn't as sensual to her as it used to be. But nonetheless, she kept her meat out. Instead of putting it right back on the line, she kept it next to her. And the supervisors would be very upset when they saw it and say, come on, what are you doing? And she said, but I kept it out in order to see how much I got done. Because that was her only sense of accomplishment that she could figure out, how much she got done by piles of dark meat that were collecting.
Well, let me ask you about, and we'll certainly return to this question because it's the central one that runs through your book, All the Livelong Day, about how workers find meaning in what are demeaning jobs. But I wanted to ask you to step back for a moment and give us a sense of how work got to the place that it is and has been for quite a long time, which is the push toward an ever greater division of labor where people like the Starlenes of the world don't see the whole of their job, and in many ways don't really have a sense of how much of the job they've done because they are just doing one part of a very divided whole.
Well, it started with Taylor and Taylorism, and also Leninism, I have to say. He adopted this. The idea that the worker would be more replaceable, would be a cheaper worker, if he didn't know the whole of the job. Because in the 19th century, say, in a steel mill, you had a guy who actually stood there and poured the metal. And he kind of decided when it was hot enough but not too hot. Very skilled. And at that point, when there were skilled workers like that, a real effort was made to go in and see what exactly they did. How many seconds might it be ready? What could you tell? So that the job could be broken down in a way that someone could stand there and be told 2.5 minutes or 2.5 seconds, not when you think it's ready. And that's called Taylorism, because Frederick Taylor studied it the best in steel mills. But it was everybody's way of doing it. That's the auto assembly plant. Each person has a small part to do on the line. And I'm not sure I'm back to making cars at hand. That's not what I'm talking about. But it did tend to make workers very replaceable. And that's really what it was about. And of course, if you're replaceable, then you're cheap. I mean, you get out, you're cheap. And so that's all over industry. And it happened in white-collar worker too. Because after I finished looking at all these blue-collar jobs, one of the chapters I wrote about in All the Livelong Day, there is something in the book which tells you that this job is disappearing. And if I had read my own book, I would know that I was not looking at American industry, but the end of it. You know, in the tuna fish plant, people would not know what time they were going to get out. Used to be that they'd work till the end of the day. Now they work till the fish ran out, and that was earlier and earlier. The ping pong plant. Oh, I looked at people in the ping pong factory where they were doing the same thing. And I wrote about it. It was a terrible place to work. And I wrote about it in Harper's Magazine. And the head of the company wrote in. And I thought, you know, they'll say terrible things about what I wrote. But I'm very accurate. People, I change names, but people recognize themselves. And they don't say I didn't say that. But the guy writes into the magazine and says, oh, yes, I didn't find any problem with her article, although she didn't say that we put up a ping pong table for recreation. But he says, but whether you like it or not, if you want to buy a ping pong set made in the United States, then you will shop for, and he names the company, which I didn't name, just as a sort of a courtesy to the workers who are so intimate in telling me their stories, and the supervisors, who they may have maligned. And so I was enough, each chapter had enough of a hint that if I had looked back and read my own thing, I could have said, hey, this is the end of the era. And indeed, by the time the paperback came out of All the Live Long Day, a third of the places I looked at had gone. And that was the beginning of something that pushed back. These young people that I talked about that wanted something different in a General Motors auto plant, they could get a job someplace else. That, starting almost immediately after my book came out, was such a fierce pushback on wages, on automation. You know, the jobs were sent abroad. And by the way, not just abroad, because industrial work is not just abroad. It's also automated here. A lot more is being done here than you think, but it's highly automated, has few workers. And it just disappeared. And under those circumstances, wages go down, people are more desperate. And we had like 4 or 5 generations of nobody talking about wanting a better job, just wanting a job at all, 4 or 5 decades. And now people are talking about it again. And I'll tell you something. It's not that there are abundance of jobs in the United States, but there are an abundance of these low jobs. Because look, first thing we did is we took industrial work and either automated it or sent it abroad. Then we took office work, which I will talk a little bit about my office jobs later. Then we took that a lot of that office work, which was not making the product, but billing and taking orders and things like that. And we know that's done abroad now, or also automated. Because, you know, when you put in the codes and the information to buy something online and you put in your credit card number, you're doing the job that used to be done by an office employee. So that work went abroad. So the kind of unemployment we see now is only in the work that's left. You can't take delivering to your door in America and offshore that. Although you could automate it. I mean, wasn't Amazon talking about having drones dropping the packages over your house? So right now, the people who are doing that delivering and packaging and warehousing, suddenly they're in demand. And they're talking about what's really bothering them, how awful the job is, and of course the pay, which wasn't a question so much in the 70s. We'd reached really the highest level of pays then.
I'm speaking with Barbara Garson. She's a journalist and playwright, author of All the Live Long Day, The Meaning and Demeaning of Routine Work, which is published by Penguin. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, Barbara, you were talking about how blue-collar jobs started disappearing in the 1970s after sort of this high point where wages had been high and workers were starting to really want to focus on the conditions of their work, not just how well they were paid or not. And then, of course, following that, these jobs started to disappear. And then there was a shift in the kind of work that was done connected to the so-called information revolution. And at the time, there was an idea that the kind of de-skilling that we saw with blue-collar work of jobs being divided into smaller and smaller bits with less and less skill would be upended with the new white-collar work around computing. Tell us how that turned out.
Right. So think how long ago I am. I had never touched a computer, but I'd read about it. And so I went to a temp agency to get a job. I live in New York, and I was sent to I wanted to try a computer, I said, data entry. And I was sent to the back office of a bank in a sub basement, windowless. And I come into this huge room with all these different women working at their workspaces, and they show me a little bit what to do. I type different numbers into different spaces, but it's completely silent for hours. I mean, I'm used to offices where people joke around and talk a little, it can be perfectly efficient, and this whole room is quiet. Not even a joke, an occasional someone handing somebody else a piece of chewing gum, but no sound. And I'm working as hard as I can. Remember, the keyboards are such that you type three letters in one space, a code for something, and then and it moves all automatically. Your cursor moves automatically to another space where you type in another two-letter code. It's so quiet. And after my third day, and there's no supervisors, just this young kid in a blazer in a windowed room, but not really looking at us, just changing tapes and things like that. And after the third day, he calls me over into his office, and he says, "What's the problem, Barbara?" Barbara yet. And he's young. Well, I was young, too. And I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, your keystroke count fell to under 15,000 an hour in the afternoon, 2 days in a row." He knew my keystroke count. He knew how it fell in the afternoon. He could probably tell when I stopped to scratch my nose. Oh, my goodness. So this is the information revolution, and I will be a brain worker. Well, this kind of thing, it didn't just stop with keystroke and data entry people. It started moving up the line, and you could just monitor not just how many, but what. For instance, at McDonald's, if you were told to push drinks, to say to each person, "What would you like to drink with that?" Not "would you like a drink," but "what would you like to drink with that?" Then the manager could say to you at the end of the day, "Well, you handled a lot of customers, but you didn't sell drinks," because drink is what they wanted to sell. Okay, suddenly stockbrokers, after I started writing about this, stockbrokers were coming to me and saying, what could they do? How could they get their own system separate from the company? At the end of the day, they would be called over and said, "Okay, you did $1.5 million in sales today, but you didn't sell REITs. You didn't sell real estate investment trusts." That's the particular thing the company was making the most off of, just like McDonald's was making the most off of soda. And so this kind of thing was moving up the line, and people really wanted to feel better about what they were doing. And of course, the job was moving away. You could be a stockbroker someplace else. You usually weren't. But the jobs that remain now, the jobs that we're hearing about strikes and organizing, are the ones that are left. If you're producing abroad, you're doing the white collar, taking the orders and typing and billing abroad, but you can't deliver abroad to people here. And that's why I was so excited when I heard that, for instance, the Amazon warehouse was being organized. And by the way, the beating them down has already started. Remember we said moving abroad and so forth? I noticed that now that these workers can feel free to move from job to job, one miserable job from another, and will sooner, and in the natural course of things, would organize so that they wouldn't be miserable jobs, I noticed that the attack against them has already started. There are states, for instance, which are proposing to change their laws, their labor laws, so that high school kids can work later at night. In most places, they can't work past 7 on a weeknight or 9 on a weekend. They're going to change those laws. They're going to do whatever they can to make those jobs, to find workers, to get cheaper workers in, and so that the workers will not feel free to work, to strike or organize. And that's happening already for the one remaining job, which is tending to fellow Americans, the care jobs, the homemaking, the things we knew enough to call essential during COVID and are now back to being minimum wage jobs.
You write, Barbara Garson, in your book, All the Livelong Day, about the ways that workers have sustained themselves through the workday to make work meaningful when, because of these processes of ever-increasing division of labor, the kind of surveillance that you've been mentioning, the speed-up that has been such a huge part of work, and the kind of control that you say is really at the heart of the division of labor, not simply efficiency. And yet, you argue that workers find it really hard to do a bad job. I mean, you've mentioned times where people might intentionally mess things up, but by and large, that's not what you found. You found that people still tried. Why do you think that is?
I think it's natural to want some achievement, to try to accomplish something. And very often, for instance, I was watching in a lumber mill, and these people's jobs were simply to put the sticks, pull different size sticks off the line and put them in different containers. And I would watch somebody who was letting it pile up, but then he would race to catch up. And he said he loved to do that. That's what he did. He challenged himself. How far down the line could it let him get past him before he ran and caught up successfully? In other words, so it didn't come crashing off the line at the end. And people were constantly doing that. In a ping pong factory, I saw a guy told me, now the supervisor was right on them in that place. It was very primitive, the supervision. She yelled at them. And this one guy, he was Haitian, and his job was merely to flip the boxes open. But he started doing it with his eyes closed. And he'd keep going until he had some fumble. And one time he just opened his eyes, and the supervisor's eyes were right up against him, looking at him doing them with his eyes closed. Well, he was just challenging himself to do something worthwhile. And by the way, I'm not saying work itself isn't worthwhile. Even in the automated places, you're with other people. There's solidarity. Remember I told you about the workers at Lordstown who were, when the quota went up, when the number of cars going past them rise, they would, if it went up by 10%, they would damage or not do 10% of the cars, which not doing your piece naturally messed up the car all the way down the line. Well, there's an archetypical story. It wasn't just young people. One of the famous stories of auto, which, by the way, I did not see myself, so maybe it's a myth, was that the guys used to play chess, and that in people who had a job, remember, it wasn't as fast as Lordstown, it wasn't 101, it wasn't 36 seconds, you might have a minute and a half to do your particular thing. One guy would double up, taking care of two cars, maybe for one or two sessions, and the other guy would make his move. And then the first guy would double up, and the second guy would make his answering chess move. This is a story you hear in auto plants. I never saw it myself. Most everything else I write about, I did see or I heard directly from someone, I believe. But that tradition goes back a long way, trying to put some meaning back into your work. And the tradition of solidarity goes back a long way, whether it's passing bones to be counted off the fish line from a woman who slowed down because the supervisor was bothering her. That solidarity and putting meaning back into it is a long tradition. I wound up doing it myself on many of these computer jobs.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm joined by Journalist and playwright Barbara Garson, she's the author of All the Livelong Day, The Meaning and Demeaning of Routine Work, which is published by Penguin. You can find a link to it on againstthegrain.org. She's also the author of The Electronic Sweatshop and the play McBird. So were there times where you saw workers engaged in autonomous and purposeful work, despite all of the forces that might push in the other direction?
Well, everything. I mean, the car does come out safe. The people that have to be taken care of at home are taken care of. People, as I said, what I first mistook as slowing down was very often temporarily slowing down so you could speed and catch up. Always it had to be within the framework of getting the thing done. I mean, when you didn't get it done, then you were sabotaged and you were caught out.
Well, you wrote about some women who were kind of different than your typical workers.
Oh, yes, yes. I did find amazing places. Sometimes if the boss knew enough to leave everybody alone, an amazing job could be done. One of the places I wrote about was the payroll office of a community college. And there, if the boss backed away, the women really knew everybody. They knew if something was wrong on the check. I mean, they would look at it. They wouldn't let a too small or a too large check go to somebody and then he has to complain. I mean, they knew who was about to get what. They understood the whole job. And yet they gave themselves a lot of time. I mean, that is to say, some people might have to bring their kid into the office for a while because of the babysitting problem, and that happened. Some people might need off because of something special that the women understood. Now, this was an era, remember, when women couldn't have very good jobs. So the people doing this work, today they would go, if they went out and worked, they'd probably be managers or supervisors. So yes, if you leave people alone, you probably find good work getting done. Not always.
One of the things that you write about is the isolation in the workplace. And you mentioned that earlier, that often people weren't talking to each other. They were just very, very focused on the work at hand, under great surveillance. And I wanted to ask you about the impediments to workers coming together collectively, although you said that solidarity is alive and well, in the places that you found. But what divisions did you see? I mean, you did write about how women often were getting the most atomized work, for example, within the division of labor.
Well, the most horrifying place I ever saw, it may seem like coal mining is hard. It is hard. But go back with me. I remember watching people doing data entry in a place where, think how far back this is, you're working on punch cards, basically, IBM punch cards. And the information comes to you in segments. You type in two letters for the date code and three letters for the city code and four letters. And the cursor, it's not a cursor, but the actual mechanism of the typing machine moves over to the next space and the next space on the card. Your mind is occupied. You can't really think about something else because you're copying numbers. Your eyes are occupied. Your feet are on the ground. Your hands are occupied. What could you be doing? And you can't talk to anybody else. I found the most amazing thing. To me, it was amazing anyway. I was talking to somebody who did that, and she said that she and her friend Ada, were both very fast typists, and that they fell into, one didn't tell the other at first, they fell into the racing. The only thing they had open were their ears, and they could hear the clank every time they moved into a new entry space. So they were kind of racing, or they didn't tell each other at first, but they were racing. And I mentioned that to some people who, at first when I asked, do you play any games with this, they didn't know what I was talking about. But then I discovered that there were people who were not racing, but wanted the synchrony. They were kind of synchronizing. They were trying to keep up exactly with the person behind them. But of course, if that person made a mistake or actually stopped, they had to move on. But one woman said to me, you know, when three people around you are moving from entry to entry at the same point, it's like three friends walking in synchrony, and it only lasts a little while, and you don't say anything, but then it breaks, but it was wonderful. And then another person told me, if there were synchronizers and racers, there was also syncopators. Another person would say, well, I would hear the sound that my machine was making in a six-digit entry, dot, 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 dot. And somebody else next to me is going, da, da, da. And somebody else is going, and I would hear them kind of, when I'm halfway through my six and she's entering her three, you're getting a da, 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 think, da, 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 ding, ding, da, 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 ding, ding. And she would, with her one free part of her body, her ears, be making up these patterns. These are the most difficult and difficult jobs to organize because you really can't talk to each other. To me, this was the ultimate when I heard about that one, which I didn't do. Now, you notice a lot of those office jobs are gone. As I said, you yourself are doing the data entry when you sign up for something and put in your date and your expiration and so on. So a lot of, and that which still has to be done is offshore. So what's left? What's left is the actual taking care of clients in the United States. If we're producing abroad and billing abroad and doing the paperwork abroad, but we still have to take care of people here. You can't help somebody with a shower from abroad, and delivery has to be done and restaurant has to be done. And that's what's left, and that's what people are organizing now. And as I said, they may not be able to move that work away, but they will definitely do whatever they can do to make those workers insecure again. And the first step is bringing young people into the job, and they're gutting the labor laws in a number of states right now to do that. And they will therefore keep the job simple, too. They won't say, well, I'll use more skilled people, and he'll do more of the process. They'll make it even simpler and simpler because they want youth that don't take any training. It's happening right now. I couldn't believe after the 70s, the attack on workers was so great. I mean, in the Reagan era, okay, it's famous that he fired all the air traffic controllers. I covered that strike too. And the effort to break that union of skilled workers, obviously you had to know something. They're mostly pilots from the Air Force. And they broke the air traffic controllers strike by sending in military people to do the job. And the same thing under Reagan, that the free zones were set up in Latin America. It's not just that our companies were allowed to go and not pay taxes for working there. They were actually given money to move their production to these free zones in Latin America where they would have no American rules and not even the rules of Central America, of the countries they moved to then. This was all the government paid to do that. I am very excited about the people who are organizing now, who are doing the work that's left in America. And I expect the attack on them to be very great.
Barbara Garson is my guest. We're talking about her book, All the Live Long Day, The Meaning and Demeaning of Routine Work. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, I want to go back to, you mentioned the 1970s, and of course that was a pivotal moment, but to the period just before then, which is, of course, now the vast majority of jobs in the U.S. are not union jobs by any means, whether in the private sector or the public sector. But in the post-war period, unions were much stronger. And yet, as you write, the issue of having a more humane workplace where workers have some control over their process of work against things like speed up, the question of a more humane workplace was not a central demand for the mainstream of labor unions following World War II. Instead, unions were focused on wages, but not on working conditions. Can you tell us why that happened? And if you think that that had lasting ramifications?
I can't say why. I mean, it's hard to, if you're a traditional labor union leader and you've been in there for a long time, obviously
you bring a contract back with a big wage increase, people are going to thank you, particularly the senior members of the union, if they get more than people who are just coming in. And it looks like, I mean, it's hard to learn about something new. Did I understand what was happening to the jobs, even as I wrote about them, even though each chapter in my book revealed another place that was could and was moving abroad? So I first let me say that it's hard for people to know. When the Lordstown workers started striking, it was a wildcat strike. Eventually, they got some support from their union. So first of all, you don't know. But we saw some bad things happening. For instance, when the machinists, when machining, which is cutting out parts, metal parts, when that started to be automated, computerized, in other words, the skill of setting it up so that you could get the maximum amount of cuts and putting things out was automated, was computerized, so that the knife, I've never seen this work, the drilling, whatever it is that cut into these stacks of metal, the programmings, the cuts, where they were going to be made, suddenly a guy in the office, maybe visible to you through a glass thing, he was controlling what cuts were being made instead of the guy at the particular workstation setting it up and cutting it. Well, that was an obvious de-skilling. And we watched a very progressive union, or somewhat progressive union, the machinists, let that happen, cooperate in that happening, on the theory, I suppose, that this is progress or can't stop it. It's efficient. Well, yes, but it left him with much less skilled labor and jobs that could much more easily be moved. So, you know, very often unions are corralled into helping the company and thinking anything that's profitable for the company will keep the job going longer. I just have to give that as a reason. I mean, I don't think anybody in the machinist was paid off to make his workers less skilled, but that's what happened. And so, again, less vital and less necessary to be nice to. You know, being nice to people, by the way, also matters a lot in your working day.
You write that in the 1970s, companies tried all sorts of different things, sometimes imported concepts from Sweden to reorganize the way work was done to make workers be more productive, but that ultimately the thing that was most effective was unemployment. And that obviously is the big shift that happened from the late 60s, early 70s to the late 70s with a major economic crisis. And of course, we've gone through another one not too long ago.
In later books, I've written a book called The Electronic Sweatshop, which was about later automation. And I've written a book, Money Makes the World Go Around, about the global economy. And I keep asking the question, you say there was a crisis in the 70s. I don't know what happened that made people able to come down on labor the way they did. Some people say there was an oil crisis, and so companies had more expenses, and they had to figure out ways to cut. It was temporary. I've read a lot of explanations about that. I don't know the answer, but at least a part of it was it took them 2 decades to get over the New Deal. It took them 2 decades not to be scared, 3-4 decades not to be scared, and it was just a smash back. I don't know whether something happened to American companies that they were no longer competitive. You know, European companies had rebuilt after the war. Maybe that's part of it. But something happened in the 70s that made them feel it was either necessary or possible, feel confident to start taking the money back.
But clearly we're still living through those times that started in the 1970s of a really all-out pushback against any gains that the labor movement had made, that workers had made, so that the idea that people should have some kind of power on the job still seems like a very distant concept, if that. I wanted to end by asking you about alternatives to the state we find ourselves in. you know, there are those who would say, well, unless we want to live in a society where we make our products from scratch, there's going to need to be some kind of mechanization, some kind of division of labor. And so, you know, what should we do? Is that the only choice? Just to go back to a previous time, I mean, obviously the social system that we operate under matters here, but how would you picture something different based on what you gleaned?
It's not for me to say that people on an assembly line want to do different parts of the work, but there are factories where people trade off sections of the line. That's a little different than each person doing a broader task. I don't know what people want. But I looked at industrial work before it moved away, and I found people having wonderful ideas for their own places and being smashed. Then I looked at office work when that was the only thing left, and that's abroad and all those telephone calls that are made from abroad. And now we have a third category of work, which is almost the only work left in a country that doesn't produce itself, which is delivering and caring for people and hospitals and things like that. And it's not for me to say how this should be done. And remember that there were many circumstances where people saved the job. When I wrote about those airline traffic controllers, who remember their union was smashed by Reagan, and they went on strike. They didn't go on strike for higher pay. They didn't go on strike for shorter hours. Believe it or not, they were on strike for their honor. For the most part, if two planes came too close to each other in takeoffs, that was considered a near miss, and the worker was blamed. It was always said near miss. But they had a rule that you were supposed to set the planes off 3 minutes apart from each other. But the airports were so crowded, airports like in Chicago, O'Hare, they were so crowded that the orders they got were no 2.5 minutes or even 1.5 minutes. And that resulted in near misses. And the near misses were accredited to the worker. And it was a dishonor. And believe it or not, that was one of the main areas of discontent, not pay at all. And they were so upset at being blamed when they were good at their job. And also, they would sometimes have strikes before the big strikes. They had little strikes. And the little strikes consisted of simply following the rules as given. I will space them 3 apart, and the planes will pile up at O'Hare because O'Hare is violating the rules, not me. Can you believe here are workers that were essentially working for our safety, but mostly for their honor? That was the most interesting strike I ever covered. And remember that those workers were smashed. Their union had no support from the other unions. Well, they were whippersnappers. They had no relationship with the other unions also, let me say. But their union had no support from the other unions. And it was not just, you know, they struck and they finally had to come back at lower pay. No, the president absolutely fired them all and sent in replacements from the military.
Can we have a society where work isn't like this? Division of labor, etc.
I think people want to do a good job. And I think we can count on if we get more input from the people working on their own. I mean, yeah, they're going to say they want, I mean, they might say they want the 40-hour week with the 35-hour lunch break. But more likely, they'll want some opportunity to get something done. I'm sure there are a lot of things to learn about what people do when there's nobody at the door and they're delivering or and there aren't enough stuffs to send out or the company's sending out the wrong thing. I'm sure we get saved by workers doing their job right as often as we get frustrated by workers doing their jobs wrong. I'm going to guess that from what I know in the past.
Given that you have written about the importance of thinking of work differently as a socialist, I wonder what you think of the idea of transcending work in a future egalitarian society.
You mean where there is no work? If for some reason that's necessary, then of course we'll all want to share the wealth, if the wealth can be produced without any real work. But I am really worried, because one of the things I
went out to find out people's complaints about work. But jobs also mean a lot to people. Being someplace where people recognize you, where you belong, where people know how you take your coffee, even if that's only the break, and on the work it's not the case. Having some input, meeting people socially, knowing what's going on, these are very important, I think. I'd rather see the workday get shorter and shorter and shorter than to see some people working and some people not. If a lot can be automated, I mean, it's very frightening to think of a production unit where there's, you know, a few people who know what's going on and the rest of the world just living, having food. So I am generally think more about sharing and redividing the work than I think about what people are talking about a lot now, which is automatic wage, a basic income. Oh, I think perhaps a basic income and jobs.
Barbara Garson, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Barbara Garson is the author of the classic book, All the Livelong Day, The Meaning and Demeaning of Routine Work, which is published by Penguin at againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to that book. She's also the author of The Electronic Sweatshop, the play McBird, and she was candidate for vice president on the Socialist Party ticket in 1992. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.